Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I am speaking first. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, I have Josh Torres.
Bon.
Mikhail Mandani.
Should I buy an Ian Tor?
Yes.
Brian Vitale.
Is there any other choice besides the Fire Pomeranian?
You heard him speak. That's Chow Min Woo.
Fire Pokemon is the only definitive answer to start your game. If you don't pick a fire Pokemon to start, you're not my friend anymore.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I was never your friend, Chow. And then finally, James Glazio.
Wow, I can't believe I'm not Chow's friend.
I guess a lot of people aren't Chow's friend. All right, have fun.
You guys are never the Charizard starter, guys. Never.
I like Squirtle, man.
Damn.
Charmander's cool, but Squirtle is... It's hard. Hard choice.
My Pokemon starting choice is like, which one is most likely to just indiscriminately bite things? So like Totodile, whatever the fire one from Scarlet Violet, I forget his name.
Was that Tepig or that generation before? I already forgot.
Violet is the most recent generation.
You have to understand. I get all my starters mixed up after like Gen 2. And that guy.
10 generations is too many. But yes, we are recording this podcast on the last day of February. This is the weekend after the Pokemon Presents. We will go into all of the everything from there. But yes, Pokemon Winds and Waves. We got 3 new starters. We'll talk about that a little bit more.
Jibanyan is the best.
I agree. So yeah, I'm looking at our outline here, and it wasn't a quiet week because obviously we did have the Pokemon. But I'm looking at, you know, we normally start these podcasts talking about, you know, big game that released, or, you know, talking about what we've gotten, you know, review up on the site for, or sometimes we branch out in other areas. This week, it just kind of happens when we record this podcast weekly and how it lines up. We don't really have any major headlining game to talk about, at least in the RPG space, in this first section of the podcast. So we're going to play this a little bit by ear. I know some of us in no particular order, some of us have been playing some Steam Next Fest demos. A lot of people have been playing the new Resident Evil game. We actually do have a feature up on the site for that. We'll kind of talk about that as well. I know Mikhail has put up a few previews for like some technical performance on some upcoming releases like Tales of Berseria, Fallout 4 on Switch 2, things like that. So no real like one we are going to talk about this game today, other than maybe, I guess, it's Resident Evil Requiem, if anything. Even though that's a little bit out of our purview, that's just kind of how the calendar lined up. Other people on the podcast, including myself, we're still playing Nioh, or we're playing games that are still under embargo, or games that are just not RPGs otherwise, etc. So it'll be a little bit more freestyle here at the beginning section. Then we'll go into the news. We'll talk about all the articles up on the site from some reviews that are up there, including the new Pokemon Presents news. And then, of course, the usual rundown of headlines, as we always do. So I kind of just put Resident Evil first. It's a bit strange to start there, but that's kind of what we ended up landing on based on just how everything kind of shook out this week. I have not played, you know, or I had no interest in the new Resident Evil game. I actually don't know, like, what it is, much about it. I'm a little bit under a rock here. Who should I hand the microphone off to? I don't know who wants to speak
James.
About Resident Evil.
James. Yeah.
Okay.
Right. There you go. Team me up. This is Resident Evil. Is this 9? Am I?
Yeah, it's 9. Ever since okay. 7, they've been cheeky, yeah. And they haven't officially had the number in the title, but there will be, like, either... Well, you won't see it in the box art for Requiem that's 9, but for 7 and 8, they actually highlight a bit of the subtitle to let you know that 7 is 7 and 8 is 8. Yeah. Requiem, what they do is in the trailers, like, the subtitle Requiem, like, those letters will phase in and out, and occasionally it would turn into a 9. So that's how they say it's a... That's how you know it's supposed to be. That's literally,
I think that's why I was confused, because I saw the 7 and 8 in the other titles, but I never saw it in Requiem. So I'm like, this is 9, right? But I hadn't seen like the animated version of the logo. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
What is Resident Evil 9?
I was going to say, I also played every single Resident Evil game, beat most of them. I'm always a huge fan. I always buy it day one.
Are you playing Requiem as well?
Yeah. I have 4 hours in.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll start with James. Yeah.
Resonate off each other. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the springboard here is like it's what we know from the marketing, it's like a dual protagonist. First, they introduced this new character, Grace, and then they introduced later that Leon is coming back as well. Very big fan favorite. Just kind of teeing up people. Like, this is a dual protagonist Resident Evil entry.
So basically the way it works is that the structure is you play a section. Well, for the first half of the game, Grace is the main protagonist, and for the second half, Leon is. But throughout the entire game, you'll be swapping back and forth. So like in the first half, you'll have like a segment of Grace and a short segment that kind of acts as a like a pressure release valve for Leon. And I say that because Grace's segments, she's a new character. She hasn't been in a zombie apocalypse yet. Leon has. So when you play as Leon, it's way more of an action Resident Evil, something like 4, 5, or 6.
And yeah, that's the interesting thing about it is like when they're introducing this game and the flow of it, it does remind me a lot of like Resident Evil 6, where Grace, like, it's like almost two separate campaigns in a sense, where like Grace is like the more horror focused perspective, while Leon is that action hero taking down armies and hordes of zombies, just being a badass.
Yep. It works really well. I feel like I should mention that up until this year, I had not played a single Resident Evil, and now I've played most of them.
Okay. Cool.
Since January?
Since January. Honestly, most of them last week.
I guess they're all not that long. Yeah.
I played Resident Evil 2 Remake, Resident Evil 3 Remake, Resident Evil 4 Original, Resident Evil 4 Remake, and Resident Evil 7 all this month.
Wow.
Okay. Well, and okay, that's a lot of Resident Evil to like inject into yourself all at once. So I guess like we don't have to get into the weeds of it, but like, what's your general takeaway of like the journey that you took like in a very short time span? And like, how does that like experience help you go through this new entry of Resident Evil?
Yeah, I will say Requiem is essentially the 30th anniversary title, and because of that, it's very self-referential. There's a lot of returning elements from previous games. Playing all of those games back to back made it very easy to recognize a bunch of callbacks. I will say that if you're going to be playing Requiem, you can just hop in there, but I would highly recommend playing the Resident Evil 2, 3, and 4 remakes before playing Requiem if you can, because they're shorter games, and obviously Resident Evil's after like a year, they're like $10 on sale on Steam, and I'm sure like almost everyone has like Resident Evil 2 or 3 remake in their library, because they've been in like however many like bundles at key sites and whatnot. But yeah, I will say, despite the fact I've played probably too much Resident Evil in the last week and a half, Requiem has been probably my favorite game in the series that I played in this, like, I guess, miniature marathon. I enjoyed it a lot.
Mikhail, you wanted to say something? That's not really like recency bias. That's like you play them all. Like, there's no nostalgia here. You've got them all like within the same frame of reference.
Yep.
Go ahead, Mikhail.
Yeah, so since you actually played them very recently, like I played them through the years since 2017, I was actually not much of a fan of Resident Evil until I played 7. 7 was like the turning point, because I have this distaste for PS 360 era brown gray visuals. And when everyone told me to play Resident Evil 4, the original, I just saw that and I still think it looks ugly dog shit. Like, I know that's blasphemy, but I do not like how it looks. So when I played 7, beyond that, played everything. I don't know, like, I haven't finished RE9 yet. I'm in two minds about it, because I feel like the gameplay is top-notch. It's like my favorite, and I've played everything since 2017, all the remasters, all the remakes. But like, you finished it. Did you feel like they leaned in too hard on the nostalgia bait?
I could see some people feeling that way, but the thing is that playing all of these Resident Evils back-to-back, just because they haven't been direct callbacks, so many of those early Resident Evils have a very, very similar through line. Like, every Resident Evil, you're going to end up in a secret lab underneath the main location, and you're going to fight some like variant of a tyrant. It always happens. It always happens.
It's also one of those things that, like, it's been a while since a mainline Resident Evil kind of leaned a little bit on nostalgia, because 7 and 8 were very much forward-facing departures of it, to great effect, you know. So them using this entry and even marketing as, like, hey, this is the thing that will kind of wrap up everything that you know about Resident Evil into, like, one package to really, you know, however this game wants to send it off, is all those prior threads are linking to this game. And, you know, I think that if it's a direct follow-up to those earlier entries, it probably should lean a little bit on, you know, what people remember and recognize from Resident Evil in that regard. Because you already had 7 and 8, which were already the departures moving into the future on that. Chad, I want to hear from you. Go for it, Mikhail.
I think the what you said absolutely makes sense. The gameplay they've made, like James brought up the pressure valve thing. I don't think a game has ever managed to do that as well as this has so far, where you have like super tense first person sections with Grace, and then suddenly you have like this Leon over the top. You can like kick zombies and do whatever the hell you want. I think that's perfect. But I just meant story wise, but then I haven't seen it through the end, so maybe I'll have something to say about next week. But I think the gameplay so far is just phenomenal, and it looks like incredible. And like, I played it on like everything. It's just insane looking game. So yeah, ciao.
Yeah, but before I get to show, I do want to comment that I think it's really, really, really impressive what they did by finally like implementing both the first person and third person perspectives there from ground zero, pretty much, instead of like having it weirdly like added as DLC, like with Resident Evil Village, where they added the third person perspective and the implementation of that wasn't great. But the way that they do it with Resident Evil Requiem is really cool, because there are some cutscenes that I don't know how many of these cutscenes are they do with this, but they're choreographed in different ways based on your chosen perspective. So like a cutscene will play out in first person if you have first person perspective, and that same cutscene if you have the third person perspective, you do get a different camera choreography with it, that now includes your character model inside that same cutscene because of the third person perspective. Like, that's really technically impressive. That's like, people don't know how much work that takes, like, you know, behind the scenes to really get that correct, and for the game to not like collapse onto itself in the process on that. So I thought that was really cool. Chow, like you said, you are a lifelong Resident Evil fan, and here's the new one. How are you liking it so far?
I love it so far. I've been playing Resident Evil since I was 8 years old. Look, I know the game says rated mature. Me and my friends, you know, just, you know, bought it from a store. Using my parents' money, and then we've been playing it in the basement. I don't know, it was a comedy. I you know, like when we played the original Resident Evil and you see the live action sequence, we thought that was a comedy.
That's timeless. It's awesome. Yeah,
it's,
I love that.
It's really funny how there was like a, not really a controversy, but like people kind of took the piss out of like an IGN headline. It's like, oh, finally Resident Evil is intentionally funny. And it's like, have you never played a Resident Evil?
Yeah, I love that live action intro, because like, especially like hearing the history of like how they created that over the years, it's like, man, they were just kind of all over the place, and a really somehow it came together in the end. But you know, back then people were not used to, like, obviously we have hindsight behind us of like, you know, we're used to visuals and performances that are like light years ahead of how the original Resident Evil was on the PS1. But back then, you know, think about it, like, that was really scary back then for people who didn't really know about how video games can be presented like that, especially the fixed isometric camera angles and the dog going through the window, of like kind of having the sound design back then, like, really jumped out at us, like to the point that, like, because it was sudden, like a sudden loudness all of a sudden, like that was enough to get us to jump like during gameplay. And it's like, because you just heard something very loud amidst this really relatively quiet sounding game, you know? And that was really something back then. Where you are right now, Cha, I you start out as Grace first. Are you still on Grace, or have you started dabbling with Leon?
The game lets you dabble with Leon at the beginning, so you kind of get like a hint of what his gameplay is like very early. And he feels like you're playing a freaking superhero. You know? This guy has the RE4 inventory system. You see like the huge amount of like the case system. Uh-huh. Then when you're like playing Grace, you're like you're stuck with that 8 inventory slots.
It's more like Resident Evil 7 with her.
Yeah, and it's almost it's like a discussion on how a woman's pockets need to be larger. Otherwise, Grace wouldn't be as scared if she could carry everything on her person.
It's really funny, like seeing like the social media comparison images of like Grace's gameplay. You know, it's like some are like filled with the Silent Hill imagery, or some are like, you know, very dark hallway with like a candlelight. And then like meanwhile Leon's gameplay, and you have like that one clip from The Kingsman playing of like the Gunkata scene in that. Others was like just, you know, crazy action sequences on that. And it's just like, it, you know, it's all true. You see the game and you see Leon has like this hatchet now, parrying attacks and like going beast mode over the fucking zombies.
Yeah, I will say, it being a Resident Evil game, obviously the final boss is some sort of like monstrosity like thing. Parrying that thing's attacks with that little hatchet was satisfying as hell, but also goofy as hell too. I loved it.
And I props to Capcom on this, but you know them consulting, you know, their female staff members on the design of Leon seems to have really paid off in spades, because a lot of people are really appreciating that character model on Leon. I see a lot of people, you know,
that Kotaku headline
getting hot and heavy.
Shout out to Kenneth. Genuinely, probably one of the funniest and like most striking headlines I've seen over the last like year.
For people who don't know, what is that headline of Kotaku?
Leon S. Kennedy, I'm on prep.
I was going to say, James, since you did like a lot of VR hacking fuckery to get some of the like PlayStation VR stuff working and to get like PC mods and stuff, I'm curious what you think, like how would you rate the Resident Evil VR experiences you've had, and do you think they'd be able to make it work for Requiem?
Oh, they absolutely would be able to make it work for Requiem, because they're like Resident Evil 4 remake is also in VR, and it's like as crazy as some of the sequels. Well, there's one. Wait, no. Yeah, they'd be able to make it work. I've been making a joke about how we should all email Gabe Newell and try to convince him to give Capcom money to make a VR version of Requiem for the Steam frame. But I'm sure people will hack in a VR mod for this eventually, because like RE Framework, same person that works on that, does a lot of these flat to VR like mods, which is also why I was able to play Resident Evil 7 that way, which I didn't even actually mention that. I did play like half of Resident Evil 7 back in the day on PSVR 1. It was like for the longest time, it was the only Resident Evil I'd played. When I was going through the series again, like this last month, I was like, okay, I'm not gonna drag out my PSVR 1, but there is a PC VR mod, and I'll play Resident Evil 7 that way. And I haven't played Village yet. That's one I'm going to probably touch after GDC. But Resident Evil 4 Remake, I also played in VR, and I played the original version of Resident Evil 4, the Quest version, like the MetaQuest version, because there's an official Quest VR port of original Resident Evil 4. So like half of the games I played over the last week have been in VR, which has been an interesting situation, because like playing Resident Evil 4 in VR and then seeing footage of people playing, it's like, man, it's a completely different vibe when you're first person basically in the experience playing it. But yeah,
I'm wondering if you wanted to play every possible SKU of Resident Evil 4, how many is that?
like 12 or something.
Yeah.
So are you talking a different ports of the same game, or like different versions which have something which sets them apart?
Let's just go whole hog. Like all.
Oh man! I don't have enough space on my coffee table if I had to take a photo of that shit. Like,
you got the PS2 version, you got the Wii version, you got the Zeebo version, you got the HD version on PS4, Switch, Xbox One. You got the original PC version that's bad. You got the new PC version that's not as bad. You got the Quest version.
You got the mobile version called RE4 Touch or whatever they did. Then you have the new remake, which is on iPhone and iPad.
You got the new remake. And if you're going to count, classify different experiences, like, you have the PS4 version, then you have the PS5 version, then you have the PSVR 2 version, which is a separate mode. So it's like, okay, if you're going to count that, you need to play both the PS5 version and the PSVR 2 version. It's a lot.
I have a question for James and Chad, who are fairly, some ways into Requiem. I'll start first with James. If you had to pick one thing you really like from this game that's like a significant improvement from any other Resident Evil games you've played before, what is it? And one cameo/callback/reference that you really sticks out of your mind that you enjoyed the most?
I will say that the first major Grace segment in the care center, which has been in like all the previews and whatnot, is probably the best that classic Resident Evil has been from the modern era. It is super, super good. Like the flow state of it, the level design, just incredible. As for references, I think the funniest thing is you can find weapon charms, and finding a weapon charm that's like the little teddy bear, kind of like the keychain from the end of Resident Evil 4, was really funny.
Okay, that's pretty good.
One of my favorite charms is the Chinese takeout box. Increase your knife stabbing skills.
Oh man. How about you, Chow? So like, same question. So far, like your favorite, like kind of moment in the game that like must have been a big improvement over the Resident Evil games you played, and like favorite cameo/callback.
Like my favorite part is I can finally use the chainsaw. You know, it's like okay, it's like the first thing that when you take control of Leon, it's like he gets attacked by these zombie doctors that have a chainsaw, and as soon as you kill the guy, you can take the chainsaw from him and start going on a killing spree with the chainsaw. So it's like, finally someone gets it. They finally can use the chainsaw. So it's like, nice. At least that's for me so far. It's like, I was not scared one bit. I think I've been desensitized from playing Resident Evil games. I was never like horrified at once at this game, even when they had that big monster that's scared of the lights.
It's because you've been playing it since you were 8. That's why.
It's like, I think I've been desensitized. It's like, I was never...
You play a lot of horror games too, Chow.
Yeah, I played Resident Evil 7 in VR. Nothing in this was going to scare me.
Yeah, that's what I hear. It's like, if you really want Resident Evil to scare you again, go play Resident Evil 7 in VR, because I hear everyone who's done that, it's like the scariest thing ever been.
Like, I try everything. I try, like, turning the lights off, pitch black. I try everything, trying to make me scared, but I wasn't feeling it. It's just like, I need some kind of adrenaline rush. When Valve mixes their VR, I'll try 7 again in VR.
Yeah, that's the funny thing, is that like part of the reason why it's taken me so long is that I guess since my first experience was trying to play Resident Evil 7 in PSVR 1, I was a wuss back then. Genuinely, I could not handle horror games. It wasn't until I kind of forced myself through Alan Wake 2, which that's a pretty scary horror game if we're being real.
Oh, yeah.
It basically just was like, okay, I am no longer scared.
Trying to think what was like the thing that finally got me just like man up on horror games. I played PS1 like scary games, but like I think the thing that really like just made me more comfortable with them was like probably either Fatal Frame or Siren. I think
I think Siren probably scared me when I was little.
Oh yeah, Siren's a scary ass game.
Because you have no tools, all you have is a different person's vision to get through, and that's pretty horrifying if you think about it. It's like real survival horror. But I was going to say, in my session of playing Resident Evil 9, me and my friend both had a stream. And then there was a Japanese girl that was watching us playing, and she was constantly being scared. It's like, because her only experience is playing Resident Evil is Resident Evil 6, which is the action game, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she was like, Koi, Koi! It's like, oh my god. It's like, and then we're like completely unhinged. So it's just like,
you guys are just like just running around, and the person's losing their mind. Got it. Way to go, Chow. Mikael, how far have you gotten into the game in terms of, like, I don't know if you wanted to answer the question of, like, what's your favorite thing so far and any callbacks you like?
My favorite thing so far is, I'm going to be boring about it, but honestly, my favorite thing so far is just the atmosphere and the lighting is, like, insane. Like, when I played 7, I thought it was fantastic, and I played it in VR, like PS VR 1, and I got motion sick and all, but the 5 minutes I could tolerate before feeling like throwing up was, like you said, the scariest shit ever. But I think, like, when you start Requiem and you're, like, walking around in the city in the rain, it's like, holy shit, this is next-gen Resident Evil. And I don't know if, I think James and Chow are playing it on Steam. I don't know if they added like DualSense haptics or whatever, but man, the Capcom went all in on that shit. Like I love it. Like I love the Switch 2 and PS5 version just because you can like feel the rain when you're walking step by step. And also that's like, cool. It's just really, really good that way.
Yeah. That reminds me a bit of a tangent, but, playing Resident Evil 4 Remake and PSVR 2, I think the coolest feature the PSVR 2 has that like pretty much no other headset has, there's haptics in the headset. So if you throw a grenade, you feel the haptics on like the dual, like the sense controllers, like the VR sense controllers, but you also feel it like the thud on the headset.
Oh, that's freaking really cool. That would freak me out, actually. That's, like, that's, oh god.
I'd love to try that. I'd love to try that. But yeah, like I just think besides the atmosphere, what I love the most about it is the balance. Like, perfect. You just enough when it starts getting too scary or too tense, they swap over to Leon. And then you, like Chow said, right, you feel like a super. You can just kick them in the face and you can parry and shit. And he has, like, the writing is also really good. Oh, yeah. I think Grace's voice actress is just, like, the highlight of the game so far. Like, what a performance.
It's almost like she's having a nervous breakdown in real life.
Yeah, it's just like, wow. Like, that's all I'll say. Like, I hopefully I finished it by next week. I just like, it's really, really like just incredible. I think like if you have a chance to try it out through like family sharing or like whenever you just get it, I'm very curious what you think about literally the opening 2 minutes of the game. Because that was just mind-blowing, that one specific, like, how is a Resident Evil game looking this good? Like, that kind of feeling.
I played it with fully maxed out on my system, and it's like, goddamn, the lighting when in some areas is just insane because of, like, the path tracing and whatnot. It's like, goddamn.
Yeah, I also hear, like, a lot of praise for this just general sound design in the game. Just not even just, like, voice acting alone, but, like, just the environmental, like, just the sound direction in general, like
that's a good point. Like, I haven't used 3D audio in a lot of games because it only works on one specific set of earbuds which I have, and I got that out for this when I was playing it, and I was like, yeah, this is like really, like, they did a really good job with that also. So
it's really funny, it's just, whenever you hear like the whimsical raccoon fucks that you want to shoot for that achievement. And it's like, you can hear them, but you can't find them. And it's like, just, it's like that one, like, prehistoric SpongeBob meme where it's like, just drop anything. It's like, where the fuck is that raccoon?
Without any context, I'm like, the prehistoric raccoon fucks. Like, okay. and before we accidentally, like, I don't want to miss this, but one person who was not able to make it on the podcast, but also has been really enjoying this game, is Colin Black. Friend of the site, contributor to the site, and he had words about Requiem and wanted to write about them. So yeah, not explicitly in our purview, but we do have a 3,000 word article from Colin just having words about Resident Evil Requiem specifically, basically like an unscored review, an opinion piece, stream of conscious. If you haven't read a Cullen review, they're a treat to read through. So he's got that up on the site at rpgsite.net. If you hit the articles tab, you should be able to see it. So I definitely do want to make sure he wasn't able to get on the podcast, but he also thought very highly of Requiem and was able to talk about it at length up on the site.
I guess, Adam, you can shed some light on this, but like, this is a game that like we obviously it's not an RPG. We don't really like covered like this type of game, but in this case, like, you got like an offer from Capcom themselves just willingly, like, hey, here's a code for Requiem to use, and you didn't even ask for it.
I mean, this is maybe not that interesting, but so last year at Summer Game Fest, Capcom was showing three main games. They were showing Resident Evil, they were showing Onimusha, and they were showing Pragmata. And I actually remember talking to Capcom PR, and they know we're RPG site, and we're like, well, we'll cover Onimusha. You know, we think that's, an action game, but RPG enough that it fits. Pragmata is kind of its own unique thing, but we probably won't cover Resident Evil. That's, that's a stretch, right? And, this was just a casual conversation, like, what fits our scope and whatnot. And then, earlier in the month, basically they're just like, hey, we want to send you a Resident Evil code. And we're like, sure. Thank you. Like, okay, we'll take it. They just were like, wanted us to cover it. So we did.
We didn't ask for it.
Yeah. We weren't planning on it, but they just wanted us to cover it. So we did.
I mean, I think that kind of just shows the level of confidence they had in the game. Just kind of right. And also just, rapport with, between us and them. So happy to have Cullen have a chance to provide words on Resident Evil Requiem with that series of events. I guess the next thing that I had listed here, unless there's any other final thoughts on Resident Evil, I know, thank you for indulging us as we kind of tangent into like a series that we talk about occasionally on the site, but not of course like our bread and butter in that sense. The next thing I do have listed here is the Steam's Next Fest demos that Josh usually kind of ends up taking point on this and kind of spearheading discussion into, interesting little, under the radar titles that end up getting platformed during this time of year, whenever Steam is able to do them in their demo festivals.
Yeah, I haven't really, like I said, I haven't really been able to dive into it as much as I wanted to. Like, there are stuff that I enjoyed, like Withering Realms, which is the follow-up game of Withering Rooms, I believe, is the predecessor of it. And that's a neat, like, follow-up to, genuinely, like, people who played Withering Rooms really liked it. It was like a roguelite, sort of horror-themed game, where you're traveling from room to room, getting, like, different weapons and stuff for, like, this. It's like almost a horror mansion style setting for that, and Withering Realms is kind of its own deal, but still has that horror theme. But it that seems to be shaping up really well. Dungeons of Dusk is one that people have been really surprised at, because obviously Dusk is sort of, when people think about that, obviously it's like that boomer shooter series. But in their next entry, they're making it a turn-based RPG. Okay, so that's also a really interesting twist on that concept. But I think the one that it's not obscure, people have known about this, but people were really, really curious to try it, is the next game from the Punkle, the creator of Vampire Survivors. And they released a demo for Vampire Crawlers, and that's obviously, I really like Vampire Survivors. I've put many hours into it, for better or worse. And I was like, I'm really curious what you have up your sleeve in this one. And it's a really interesting, it's not necessarily what if Vampire Survivors was a dungeon crawler, because there is like distinct like map design in like how you're traversing these floors, but like all the tools that you're given in these like first person turn-based dungeon crawler encounters all uses very familiar imagery from Vampire Survivors. When you have like the Bible, for example, you know what that's gonna do. So like in Vampire Survivors, those are the rotating things that sort of act as your shield that does damage. It's like almost a barrier of sorts. But in this one, when you're playing this Bible, I guess card or ability, it does has that same sprite from Vampire Survivors. and its effect in the in this combat is like it'll deal damage to all the front row enemies in front of you for this amount. But and then like the axe from Vampire Survivors, also in Vampire Crawlers, this will do a lot of damage in an arc, and the way that like you're facing off against enemies is like they're it's very much like in a it's a like the first person dungeon RPG where they're coming to you like in waves. So like the first front row is like the ones that will immediately attack you. After you get rid of that row, the next row comes in after them. And that's like your next thing to deal with, and your use and your abilities all have an SP, or I forgot if it's SP or AP cost. I forgot, but they all have some sort of cost, and you can only play a certain amount of them until you know your resources run dry. There are some abilities like buffs that you get to cast for free if you happen to draw them, but usually attacks, offensive tools, they do take a certain amount of like action points to pull off. But in exchange, you know, as long as you have the action points remaining, you can burn as much of your offensive tools that you've drawn as long as you have the AP to use them. And there is a certain strategy to, like, when you want to cast them, because there are, attack modifiers. If you use them consecutively, so for example, if you use something that costs 0 AP, then 1 AP, then 2 AP, then every step of the way, the if you're casting them consecutively, they'll get continually buffed. So if you cast the 0 AP ability or move first, then the one that has the 1 AP gets like a bonus stats, bonus damage. You cast that, then the one that you're going to use for 2 AP gets an even bigger bonus modifier to it. So then that also factors into, like, you know, you're not just willy-nilly spending everything immediately. You're trying to think of, like, what is the order I want to spend this in? And it feels pretty good. Like the core concept, the core loop of it is already engaging, and I already can't wait for the full game. I only played just a little bit of it, like the first, like, full dungeon. There are obviously unlockable characters that you can unlock that have their own sort of decks and like specialty, and like say one is better with axes over the Bible, for example, in that regard. But I only played just enough to say, or to make me go, okay, I'll go buy the full game when it comes out. And that was a lot of fun. I'm really interested to see like how deep this game goes, because you know, Vampire Survivors, you could kind of play almost forever the way that game is expanded. I'm really curious what Vampire Crawlers will do. And I'm crazy, like, you know, if it becomes like a hit, what sorts of like crazy collabs it's gonna have, because you know, when Vampire Survivors first came out, we never knew that was gonna get like a fucking Saga collab, you know.
I'm gonna say the Saga Emerald Beyond collab, like,
yeah.
Can't name two more disparate things. Yeah,
exactly. You know, then it finally got like a proper like collab, like Castlevania, you know, and all that stuff, and that was great. So I have to imagine if this game's a hit, I wonder what sorts of like, you know, dungeon RPG collabs it'll have to make it, you know, add on more things, more twists to it. So that was really cool. Vampire Crawlers already shaping up to be stupidly addictive and something that I'll burn a lot of hours into.
And something that we're actually covering now.
But one thing that that Josh talked about, you know, in passing there was the new Dungeons of Dust game from New Blood Interactive. So I know that looking ahead at one of the articles that we put up this week, Mikhail, you had a chance to speak to Dave Ostrey of New Blood Interactive, not just about Dungeons of Dusk, but about that and other things. So, and I've seen a few, I guess, like snippets from this interview that you had kind of make the rounds, not necessarily the Dungeons of Dusk ones, but things about, you know, marketing, game stores, Epic Game Store in particular, things like that. But you had a very lengthy interview with Dave Ostrey. Like, what, you know, what was that experience like? How many times have you had it? How many opportunities have you had to chat with him?
So I interviewed him. This is the second time I've interviewed him.
Okay.
When I did the first one, it was for TouchArcade.com. And it was for that, it was literally just because I was getting into Boomer Shooters and I was kind of obsessed with Dusk and like whatever New Blood releases, I just like sent him an email and said, I want to interview you. Do you want to do it? And he said, yeah, sure, let's do it. And I literally just spoke to him for an hour that time. It was a super fun interview. Had similar reactions to it based on what he said. Like a lot of quotes taken out, posted all over the place. But that was just the general Boomer Shooter thing and generally New Blood stuff. So when Dungeons of Dusk was announced, I was like, okay, I can talk to Dave Oshry again, and now like on a new publication, and basically just one thing led to another, and I got to talk to him, and we were planning out when to do it, because he told me that the Steam Next Fest demo was coming out, and he sent me an early build of it to play, so I could like talk to him about that. And when I asked him how long, like just some behind the scenes stuff, usually when we do interviews, either we send questions by email and you have like a limit, like you can send 10 or 15 questions, or you have like a interview on call and you have like a fixed amount of time. So I expected it to be half an hour. So when, before we got on the call, I said, how much time do you have? He's like, I have how much ever time you want. So I spoke to him for 1.5 hours. Like it was a super fun conversation. Focused on Dungeons of Dusk in the beginning, and then I picked his brain on just general stuff, because he's very like, he doesn't give a shit about anything, like he just speaks his mind. So like he's gotten to arguments with Tim Sweeney on Twitter and stuff about the Epic Games Store, and that's actually something which I spoke to him about when I interviewed him before as well. So I just asked him about that again, asked him about how he handles PR outreach and all, because they are very like, they don't usually like send emails with press releases and stuff. They just post stuff on social and on Steam, and people who want to cover it, cover it. And like, I covered that also. Like, are you just happy reaching out to the same people? And generally, like a lot of things like that. And then I asked about GOG, because while talking about storefronts, everyone talks about Steam's 30% cut. And then the GOG quote, which is what he said, that it'll only survive if people keep giving a shit. And that actually got enough traction that GOG put out a statement and quoted him. So that was like funny. Like I had a, my interview led to GOG putting out a statement about preservation, which was funny. And yeah, basically like just, I usually do not like, when I do these interviews on call, I don't like editing too much and sanitizing it, because I kind of want to have the vibe of the interview and the call present throughout. And all the feedback I got from this interview on like Blue Sky and Discord, everyone's just very happy with it. So I was happy with it because it took a really long time. I think this is the longest interview I've put up on RPG side, and I've done quite a few so far. So yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. If you want to read it, it's really, really long. So grab a big glass of coffee or whatever. And yeah, and speaking of coffee, like, I sometimes talk to him on email about other stuff, and also then when I ask him about coffee, he's like, you keep asking me about coffee. It's become like this in joke now. So yeah, he mentioned where he gets his beans from and stuff. So yeah, I covered literally everything. And the one, some stuff which I think was interesting on the console side is, Nintendo seems to not be allowing devs to release stuff they have ready for the Switch 2 yet. So they're kind of controlling the eShop based on what he said. Like he said, they have Dusk, the Boomer Shooter, running at 120 FPS with mouse controls on Switch 2 with a dev kit, obviously. But Nintendo still being a bit cagey on who can release what on the eShop to prevent it becoming from like full of slop like the Switch 1 eShop and stuff. And also like I said, right, he doesn't give a shit when he talks about stuff. He'll just speak his mind. So he just keeps saying consoles are a pain in the ass, but because people keep asking for our games there, we'll put it there because we make our fans happy. And then he also spoke
very candid, like, and yeah, not like in a judgmental way, but when he says consoles are a pain in the ass, like he's like, but he realizes how important they are, and therefore that's a specific pain in the ass that he's willing to deal with. But then there's certain other things where Adam can probably speak to this. Like when we get interview opportunities, a lot of them really are just thinly veiled, please market our game for us in the vein of an, you know, in the corpse of an interview or whatever. And we're like, eh, and we try to avoid those, but sometimes you do have to toe the line a bit. But this interview is definitely not that. This is just him being completely candid, to my impression.
Thing changed, and I think this and the interview I did with Johnny from Health last year, I feel like have a similar vibe, and it kind of makes sense because they both worked together on music for Ultra Kill, which is another game from New Blood, which actually had like a new, I covered that also in the thing. They were talking about what they have planned for this year because they've started publishing other games as well. And he was also talking about how he reads RPG Side, and he's like, I've been reading it for so long. This is the first time they've actually covered something we've done. So that's cool. But yeah, it is true because Dungeons of Dusk is a turn-based dungeon crawling RPG. So we can cover it. And probably will be like, it's something which they plan on launching on every platform instead of doing an early access launch on PC and taking like 10 years to release it on other platforms, because he even admits to that they have so many games in early access on PC that they want to avoid doing that for this. And they worked with an external Italian developer who has first person dungeon crawlers on Steam already. So they just reached out to him and said, do you want to do this? And yeah, it worked out over there. So I love Dusk and I'm very happy that this is happening, and because like more Dusk games are always good. So there was one thing I wanted to talk about with the console stuff. I'm just trying to remember which specific part it is. Yeah, so I asked about, because like there was this thing where after I did the interview was done in January. He actually posted on Twitter about how he did an interview, which was referring to this one. And he mentioned it also that the Epic Game Store like is a marketing black hole. That's become this famous line everyone attributes to him. Even I do, even though he didn't say it, but he talks about it. And he mentioned how there's this game Blood West, which they publish. They got it under their wing now. And during Christmas, Blood West was free on the Epic Game Store. And New Blood doesn't actually control that. The dev controls that. And when it went free, he thought it would affect the Steam sales. But it actually ended up boosting their Steam sales when it was free on the Epic Game Store. So he said, it's so useless right now that it literally advertises for other platforms. That's how much of a waste the Epic Game Store is. And I also asked him what he thinks about Play Anywhere. And he was just talking about how they finally got some games on Xbox. And one thing I didn't realize is that when they do Play Anywhere, they basically just ship the console game on PC in this case. Yeah. So that it's like a universal build. Because in some cases, there have been instances where the PC version and console version are different. So in this case, he just confirms you can do that. So that was interesting.
And yeah, that's happened like, a couple of times, because I do remember back when No More Heroes 3 was new, people didn't immediately realize that the Steam PC version at the time and the Play Anywhere PC version were two different versions. That's no longer the case now, but it was really funny when people realized, wait a second, if you want to play the Xbox version on PC, you can, and for a time, that was the best way to play No More Heroes 3 on PC.
Oh, yeah, because the Steam version was built using the Switch base or something like that, right? I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the PS5 and Xbox version had the larger draw distance, and they had like higher res textures. And then, yeah, I remember this now. But yeah, I think if you care about indie games, if you care about storefronts, and you just want to read a fun interview, like I don't like tooting my horn or whatever, but I think this is just a really fun read, and it's a very long read, so enjoy. Hopefully.
No, thank you definitely for putting that together, Mikhail, and for reaching out to make the interview happen in the first place. Just making sure we didn't tie up any loose ends here. Were there other demos that you had a chance to get hands on this week, Josh?
Like the other like non-RPG demos, like I tried out this game called Gunboat God. That was really fun. And then I also have two other demos, Ruin, Beast City, and Starship Troopers Ultimate Bug War, that I've yet to try out. But We'll see if I can get around to them.
Looking at other articles on the site, this is a good enough time to slot this one. And so a game that did release just a couple days ago and is definitely in our purview is Towerborn. So Adam, chime in, interrupt me if I get any of this wrong. This was originally announced by the developers are Stoic. Stoic is most known for the Banner Saga trilogy, which was like a isometric tactical RPG with a through line story, like a very story heavy tactical RPG from like the 2010s. And Towerborn was announced as a co-op free to play online beat 'em up, like left to right beat 'em up, which was interesting. It seemed like a bit of a departure. And it's still that, but Hayes Madsen went up and put together a Towerborn review up on the site, as well as an interview with Stoic talking about the game. Of course, the game is no longer free to play and online. It is still a side scrolling beat 'em up, but it is a more conventional single player, non free to play, I guess, premium, quote unquote, project. But still, one thing that Hayes goes into for his review is that it still is playing to Stoic strengths in terms of having like a really deep story, a lot of really cool and intricate world building, but in the format of a game that typically is very story light, like side scrolling beat 'em ups are typically like arcade games, right? Where you just kind of, you know, put in your quarter and you play, right? People my age remember that. He talks about how in a lot of ways it works, in a couple of ways it feels a little bit incongruent. I don't want to put words in Hayes's mouth though, so go ahead and go to read his review on the site, Towerborn Review. And then he also got a little bit more details from Stoic, the developers, in that interview about transitioning from the originally envisioned free-to-play model to the model it ended up launching with, you know, this month. So definitely worth checking those out. And we'll see if we can get him on the podcast to talk about that at some other point in potentially March or April about his time with Towerborn. We do also have a couple more things from Mikhail here, just kind of wrap up this section. You took a look at this is a game that we've talked about, and it was announced recently, the Tales of Berseria remaster. Of course, Tales of Berseria originally released like 8 or 9 years ago, and now it's being remastered. We talked about that at length. You put a few impression pieces up on the site for consoles versus, you know, Switch 2 and Switch 1. PlayStation 5 versus the original version. Do you have just like a key takeaway from your time with that?
Yeah, so I had access to the PS5 version for like through review code, and because we've already covered it and it's like it didn't seem like it was doing enough to warrant a full review, I just thought, like I told Adam, I'll just see how it improves or compares to the original PS4 version, and I was just going to do that. But then I remembered, so here's the thing with all these Tales remasters, everyone keeps bugging me to cover the Switch version because they want to play it on Switch, which fair enough. But because, like I have this article on the site where I covered every single Tales of game backward compatible on Switch 2, because not all of them play the same. Like Vesperia is actually 60 FPS on Switch 2 because it was just uncapped and unstable, a mess on Switch 1. So every time there's a Tales of remaster announced, people ask me to try that. And I'm like, fine. And I absolutely love Berseria as a game itself. So what I realized is I can just buy the thing on the Japanese eShop and get it like 2 days before it unlocks in the US. So I did that. I just pre-ordered it. And since I bought it, I covered it based on that. I just wrote about how the Switch version plays on Switch 1, how it plays on Switch 2. It is not good. It's like a big step down from the PS4 version. So I don't want to waste too much time on that. But yeah, you can read that. The more interesting thing is how they, like, you know, I wanted to see what they do to justify the PS5 version. Because, like, you know, obviously they're doing it to have more retail presence. Because now you can sell a $40 version instead of the PlayStation Hits branding $20 version on PS4. So they added some quality of life stuff, like you can have the whole map revealed when you get to a new area before you explore it as an option. You can hide the destination marker or enable it, something which they should patch into Dragon Quest VII Reimagined. And then, you know, they always add DLC to the remaster, and they say that it includes most of the DLC, or they say it includes all the DLC except for some stuff. So my PS5 review code for this was the deluxe edition, so I just put together a DLC guide to cover what DLC from the original is included for free and what isn't. So except for the Idolmaster costumes, I think everything was included. So I have a list of everything over there. And for the PS5 version, actually, they did improve on the PS4 version. So like it's much higher resolution and the draw distance is better, because like there's something which I, like my rose-tinted memories of the game, I did not realize how bad the draw distance was on PS4, and maybe it's because I wasn't playing and paying attention to that stuff back then. But when I played the Switch version, I was like, what the hell, like the grass is just popping into the screen in front of me, what's going on? And my friends, like, you didn't have Digital Foundry brain back then, which fair enough, but yeah, the Switch PS4 versions are like kind of whatever, like they really needed more work. And I don't have the PC version to compare because I never got that and I didn't have time to play more. And I feel like the staggered release, like, you know, I like you joked about it last time, like we have three articles for Proud Nordics because there's so many platforms. Like with Tales of Berseria, I was like, if I get PC later, it's going to be like one more late article or whatever. But yeah, I mainly wanted to just do the PS5 to see how it improved on the PS4 version. I think it's, if you haven't played it recently and you want to replay it, I think it's worth the 40. If you played it recently, I don't think it's worth it. Like, just wait for a sale or whatever. The one thing I have heard from a friend who got the PC version is it's still capped to 60 FPS, which is disappointing. Because the other Tales of games on PC, the remasters, let you play up to 120. So that's kind of disappointing. And yeah, like, that's basically the main takeaway. Like, I would not recommend playing it on Switch 1 or Switch 2. It feels sluggish compared to the PS4 version from, like, 9 years ago. PS5 version's good. PC version, I hope, is good. But I will eventually get to it. I don't have time for it right now. So,
no, yeah. That makes sense. And the thing with PC version is that the dialogue sometimes gets muddled because, like, what was available out of the box versus, you know, what's already been, like, well-established and modded, you know, that you can already get on the existing PC version with, like, special.
The one, you know, I'm glad you brought up the mods because the original game was obviously, I forgot what engine it was. I think Cryware or something. But the new version of Berseria Remaster is actually made in Unity. So I'm wondering if it being in Unity on PC means mods will be easier than whatever engine they used before. That's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, like, I don't have it yet. The one thing I did notice is it is Steam Deck verified, while the original is marked as Steam Deck unsupported. And the original works fine on Steam Deck, except for apparently there's an issue with the game where it does not run at 60 FPS properly on PC. You have to play at 58 or 59 FPS, some engine issue. But this is something which, if I had the PC version, I would have examined. But yeah, that's just one thing to keep in mind. But yeah, like, I did all this because I really, really like Berseria. It's like either my first or second favorite Tales of game. So I definitely would not have done this for, like, I will not do it for Zillia 2. Like, I'll just do the whatever I get and move on. That's not something I care about. But yeah, hopefully more people play it right now. At least it's on Switch and Xbox. It wasn't there before. It was just PlayStation 4 and Steam back in 2017. So yeah, still really enjoy the game.
Before we get into headlines, there's a few other articles that I want to shout out. We do have one up on the site this week from Alex Donaldson about a game that, again, is kind of like not our normal purview. This is, and I've seen this make its rounds in at least my sphere of social media, Star Trek Voyager Across the Unknown. It's like a strategy game. So, like, those have always kind of had, like, you know, been RPG adjacent, or at least in the same, you know, extended family. Alex obviously is a big fan of these styles of games. I don't want to speak for him, but I believe XCOM, Enemy Unknown, or Enemy Within, one of those is, like, within his top five, if I remember right. So I am not surprised when I saw this pop up. Like, yeah, this is definitely a game that Alex would take the opportunity to write about on the site. So he talks about Star Trek Voyager Across the Unknown as a strategy game, how it has, like, you know, it's a really good fit for people who enjoy those styles of games. Though he does also talk about how it feels. You can tell it was a small game made by smaller team on a modest budget. So it, you know, just things to keep in mind on that. And I have seen some, like, social media impressions talking about how, like, slow the game is, with a few people, for better or worse, being like, have you seen the show? Like, it is a very, like, episodic, deliberately paced, late 90s TV show or whatever it was. But yeah, just at least wanted to shout out that we did have that feature up on the site as well. And then lastly, just very quickly, Mikhail, very quickly, you looked at Fallout 4 Anniversary on Switch 2.
I completely forgot that was this week. I felt like it was last week. But yeah, quickly, it's not a bad port like Skyrim was at launch. It's actually really playable.
I thought,
yeah, I am too.
Move on.
No, I am too. Like, Alex told me get on it ASAP, so I bought it as soon as it, like, pre-ordered it on the eShop. And then it's a 60 GB download, which is kind of annoying because of how expensive storage is on Switch 2. But they just shove every single language together, unlike other platforms where they, like, let you download what you need. But the game itself is good. Like, it's not a shit port like Skyrim was, like, initially at launch. You have, like, a 30, 40, and 60 FPS option for both docked and handheld play. The only one downgrade for this compared to other platforms is you don't have access to the creations mods. like the custom ones, I should say. This is just whatever was included in the anniversary edition. You can't like download mods which give you like extra inventory space or like, you know, the fan-made stuff. So that's like the main annoyance over that. But it's a very good port and they are improving it also. They said they are patching in DLSS in the next update, which should help the 60 FPS and 40 FPS modes because those look a bit soft. But yeah, I did a quick comparison and like impressions covering how it feels compared to Steam Deck, how it feels compared to like the PS5 version. And I am playing it like actually like properly, not just for tech stuff, on Switch too. So when that update comes, I will probably like either like update this impressions thing or like just talk about it on the podcast. But yeah, it's I'm enjoying the port. So yeah, good on them for like not shipping dog shit.
Oh yeah, I'll be honest. That's when I was asking you to like really quickly summarize it, I was expecting it to fall on the other side of the
yeah, same here. Like when I downloaded it, I expected it to be good.
All right, I think I have a tendency to accidentally skip things. I think I covered all the things that we intended to kind of in this little bit of a smorgasbord of a first half of the podcast here. We have, you know, Towerborn review. We have the Dave Oshry and New Blood Interactive interview. Tales of Berseria, Fallout, all up on the site. Going into headlines and announcements, just like we teed up at the very, very, very beginning of this podcast. Yeah, this week was Pokemon Presents. So the big announcement from that, one of many, but the main one that everyone was looking forward to is Pokemon Generation 10, Pokemon Winds and Waves. We got a new announcement trailer for that. It is coming to Nintendo Switch 2, obviously. The one thing that was a bit of a surprise is that it is slated to release worldwide in 2027. So not this year. So that was a little bit of a surprise for some people. The trailer showed, you know, a lot of the like the environments, the, you know, the two protagonists default looks, all those sorts of things, as well as of course the three starters. So the three starters that we saw, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of discussion about these in addition to what we already had at the beginning, is that the grass starter, Brout, looks like a leaf-themed Angry Bird. The fire starter, Pombon, a fire like Pomeranian. I've seen already many, many comparisons to like Missile from Ghost Trick. And then the water starter, Gekua, who is, I wish I had something like really latch onto here, but it's like, who is a water starter? Who is an amphibian? Yeah, but
I've seen Blue Gex for Gekua.
Blue Gex. That's a good one. All right. There's a few other things, of course, like there's like these two Pikachu NPCs who are called like Mr. Wave-a-chew and Miss Win-a-chew or something like that. They look like Texas tourists vacationing in Italy with like suntans or something like that.
This trip will save their marriage.
Yeah. I've seen that the default female protagonist looks like she is a greeter at Walmart or something like that. But anyways, you know, there's a lot we could dig into here. What did we think about the initial showing for Pokemon Winds and Pokemon Waves? I'll start with James.
So as someone that I feel like I've been like kind of stop and go with regards to the series, I say that, but I've played every single one that dropped Switch era. But I was disappointed with the initial launches of both Sword and Shield and Scarlet and Violet. But looking at this first reveal, knowing that it's over a year, well, maybe not over a year, but it's like a year away at minimum, I'm feeling pretty good. Like the fact that it's not going to be on Switch 1, which means that the scope of the world is going to be able to, it's going to be improved because you have a lot more RAM to work with, a better CPU to work with. The fact that visually the game already looks like actually good. That water looks genuinely like the water, the wave tech and like the cloud tech actually looks good. Like no qualifiers. It looks good.
The world I didn't design, think so when I first saw it until someone put it side by side with what was there in I forget if it was Sword Shield or Scarlet. It was like, here's how it used to look like. And I'm like, oh, I had flushed that out of my brain. Yeah, it looks way better than what was shown in Winds and Waves so far.
Yeah. And the fact that there's like proper underwater segments, there's proper caves. It's like, okay. The world design of this new region is looking pretty promising. I loved pretty much all the new Pokemon they added with Scarlet and Violet. I don't think the actual Pokemon they added was anyone's issues with those games. But yeah, I'm feeling pretty excited. I'm pretty hopeful.
Yeah, I'm here's like, it's cool. Like, I'm glad they're not rushing out for holiday 2026 like they usually tend to do. So I'm really glad that about that it's still next year. And I'm glad that it switched to exclusive for the reasons that you mentioned. Like, my only concern is I hope that they, you know, still prioritize maintaining 60 FPS performance. They did a great job with ZA and then getting Scarlet and Violet up to, you know, that Switch 2 spec, making it run better is great. I just really hope that they don't fall into the trap of like, well, we have much more powerful hardware, so we should go cram in all these awesome graphics and at the cost of performance in that regard. I really hope they do have a spec for 60 FPS like they did for ZA.
The trailer itself was 60 FPS.
Yeah, so, but I'm hopeful for the final game. I'm not saying that like they're deceiving us. I'm just like, you know,
Josh will take a. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wary because I know the Pokemon being, you know, running at a smooth 60 FPS is still relatively new, uncharted water for them.
Maybe it's me being a bit like naive, but I feel like the fact that they deliberately didn't launch this on the 30th anniversary, they waited. They're skipping a year, which when was the last time they skipped a year? Genuinely.
I have no idea. I don't keep up with Pokemon releases after, that
wasn't closely. It after Scarlet Violet?
No, because they did the DLC.
But I was going to say, like, Josh is going to take psychic damage if they add, like, depth of field.
By the way, there's motion blur, depth of field, and you can't switch them off. Have fun, idiot. I'm like, oh, fuck. But what they showed at the teaser, like, they kind of did a fake out first because they kind of did like this almost sketchbook-esque, like, you know, reveal. It's like, okay, what the hell is this? Until you got the introduction of like the door opening, and then you see a body of water, and then you see like these two weirdly designed Pikachus of like what we later knew, as you said, those Baby Chu and Windy Chu, which is, you know, they're being enigmatic about them, but it is really funny to see what people's interpretations of them are at the moment. But after that and getting to the actual proper reveal of the game, the thing that really struck out of my mind is like the atmosphere that they're going for is very reminiscent of the very first episode of the Pokemon TV series. It's like when they first showed off Pokemon in that first episode, it is that environmental shots of Pokemon living in the environment. It's like a very almost mystical, enigmatic shots, because you didn't know what Pokemon was yet. You just saw like these weirdly designed creatures like swimming in the water, flying in the sky, you know, being by different biomes, and you're like, man, this is a weirdly cool world with like different creatures that I've never seen before. And the way that they did the camera composition and choreography of this trailer, it really reminds me of that very first scene in the very first episode of the Pokemon TV show, where it still had that sort of like mystery behind it. I'm like, oh, that's really cool that they're kind of framing it like this.
And Josh, what did you think? I don't know if I saw this officially confirmed, but people were looking at some screenshots and like the sorts of trees that were around, that they believe that this is based off like Southeast Asia, like, you know, how different Pokemon games like Scarlet and Violet are based off Spain, Sword and Shield are based off England, Kalos, I hope I get the term right, was based off France, you know, Sun and Moon off like the Hawaiian Islands. Like, people say like, oh, this is Southeast Asia, this is the Philippines.
I could see, I mean, like, there's nothing in particular in the trailer that maybe makes the screams like, hey, it's the Philippines, but it'd be really cool if it was like a Southeast Asian region that was like, you know, reminiscent of the Philippines. Like, I haven't really dug deep into like, you know, whether it is or not. Like, I saw the trailer once or twice, and I didn't like really dig deep too much into like whether it's the Philippines or not. But if it is the Philippines, you know, then fucking Filipinos rise up, man. It's our time finally. That'd be pretty fucking cool.
I remember when I first saw it, I was like, didn't like it starts out relatively tropical, And I guess it kind of maintains relativity. And I'm like, oh, but didn't we already do this with like Sun and Moon and Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon? Like, to me, it felt like, oh, it's tropical again. But in the reach of looking back through the trailer, like it does, yeah, it does have that. But it does also feel like it has its, I think, just the fact that it's more like well realized in terms of like the underwater areas, the caves, the, you know, all the aerial shots. I don't know. It does feel like something new. It doesn't feel like a retread.
Yeah, like okay, like if this is actually like for real, like yeah, it's Philippines, then I will be triply more interested than I am now if it actually is the Philippines, because I didn't really think about it that much, admittedly.
Yeah, but, no, I just saw a headline come across. Like I wouldn't have put it together, but I just saw a headline come across my feed. I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because I haven't, you know. Every Pokemon area is based off a certain region of either Japan or the world.
Look, so if they have dishes that you can feed lumpia to your Pokemon in this game, we're fucking cooking. If we can beat Pokemon with valise, which are kind of like small wooden reeds that you use as like a broom in the Philippines, then we're fucking back. You know, it's let's go all the way with it then.
Hell yeah. So obviously the news from this like is going to trickle in over the next, like James said, year plus. Obviously, as with any generation, there's already been a ton of fan art. I like it even in my friend circle. Like people that don't play Pokemon love indulging in this shit. Just like people like painting each of the starters in their own style. People kind of just making serious and silly guesses about what the evolutions will look like. People are already saying like, Pombon, please stay on all fours, please don't become firefighting, and like put on,
yeah,
like
that's
a,
what I was, that's why I saw Pombon, I'm like, I'm definitely choosing Pombon. I cannot not choose Pombon, but I hope its evolutions are just like, it just gets bigger and nothing else changes about the design. It just gets bigger. That's my ideal Pombon evolution line.
It's like same size, more fluff, same size, yes. More fluff. Now angry eyebrows. New eyebrows. Every evolution, Brout's leafy eyebrows just get bigger until they like.
It's just so fun. I love all the Brout stuff too, because like, what is like recolor gun angry birds to its color scheme? What is like its evolution is like, it has longer eyebrows and longer legs.
I saw one joke that took the Gekwa starter and like, he evolves into Randall from Monsters, Inc. Just with Gekwa's face.
Nice. They really nailed it with the starter designs, though. They're all pretty unique in their own way and kind of funny looking. And the way the starters, you'd hope a starters look. Like, they definitely are, they have fun names and they have fun themes going with them. And that's a pretty good starter lineup, in my opinion.
There were a few other headlines in the Pokemon Presents. I didn't watch this directly, so I only saw the headlines. So I only listed two in an arbitrary order here. They did announce that Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness. This was like the single player RPG from like that weird GameCube area where we got like Pokemon Colosseum, Gale of Darkness, and a few others. It's going to be launching on Nintendo Classics on Switch 2 in March. And then Pokemon Champions. This is like that competitive Switch/mobile game is going to be releasing this April. April for Switch and then summer for the mobile port. So that's only two headlines I other pulled out. Adam or anyone else who watched the Pokemon Presents, was there anything else to pull out of what they showed other than the Gen 10? You know, obviously
the headline. They showed some more, I guess people like dug out like the Pokemon Champions website. They showed like some NPCs on it that they really haven't, I guess, officially or formally advertised for it yet. But there are some like cool character designs from that Pokemon Champions game, and that this is the entry that's like live PvP focused, launching on Switch first and mobile later. But you know, people are already going wild over the character designs from that upcoming game. Like I know one is like a lady that's like a rancher farmer, has like a cool hat. People have been going wild over that. One is sort of like I guess a researcher, or the sort of, I don't know what their names are. I just saw their designs. I'm like, those are really some cool designs. I don't know how much I will spend on Pokemon Champions, but I do want to check it out because I do like the battle system of Pokemon games. So that being more hyper-focused on battles and having a more persistent progression on that, like, has potential. I really like, say, Pokemon Stadium, for example, on N64. Like, I really like that, playing it with, that with other friends. So Pokemon Champions is, like, sort of like the evolution of that whole line. I could be, this could be interesting to me.
When I think Pokemon Stadium and N64, I think of the Lickitung sushi minigame.
That's true, too. The minigame.
I would play like a Mario Party game, like in the Pokemon skin, with just a bunch of minigames, because they indulged in it in like Stadium 1 and 2, but not since, to my memory. But yeah, those were.
They also, look, it's not a Pokemon Direct thing without having some really stupid announcement. And obviously this won't, I'm not the target audience for it. I know several people are, but they announced this Pokemon Game Music Collection. And it is a pack of like this replica of a Game Boy, but it doesn't play Game Boy games. And all it does is play these musical cartridges. There are 45 of them. And you swap them in one by one. All of these Game Boy cartridges just contain one music track that you slot into this Game Boy replica to play a song that's supposed to reproduce the sound of the GBA or the original Game Boy tracks, Pokemon tracks, faithfully on it. And I really don't know who this is for, but I guess I'm happy for the people who it's for. But for me, I'm just like, this is such a big waste of plastic of like having this 45 distinct Game Boy shaped cartridges to slot into this Game Boy shaped device that its whole purpose is to play the tracks off of these cartridges.
Josh, you missed a very important part of this equation. What is its purpose? By having that many cartridges, it justifies making the price triple digits.
Yeah,
I saw this headline, but I did not see any of these details in terms of like the one 70? Song per cartridge thing.
I didn't actually see the pricing. I didn't see 70. The pricing yet. Okay.
But it's only sold at Pokemon Center in like select countries.
It's 2000.
It's only in only being sold in the United States, Canada, and United Kingdom right now in Pokemon Centers.
Huh.
The one thing I'm confused about is this kind of like goes back to the Fire Red Leaf Green thing also. When they showed this, I thought this was going to be like a $150 or $200 thing, and it would just have like the soundtracks you can listen to from like all the, or like, you know, you can buy different cartridges and you get the complete soundtracks for the other Pokemon games, because a lot of them are on streaming or like iTunes and stuff already. So I was just like, you're doing this for just one game? Like, what is going on? And then it just reminded me of how like Fire Red Leaf Green is like, that should have just been like an app you can like buy DLC and get all the other classic games instead of just being like a standalone ROM with one language. And like, yeah, it's just, I don't know, I'm confused about this. Like, I'm not some hardcore Pokemon fan or anything, but it just feels like baffling that they're just doing it this way. So whatever.
It's like one of those, it's like, who would ever do it this way? But at the same time, it's like, it's the most Pokemon thing ever as well in terms of merchandising. So it's like, fuck. I don't know. I need someone who is more knowledgeable about this, like the audio quality and authenticity of these tracks, to be like, this is the best shit ever. It's the most, nothing has reproduced the sound of the Game Boy soundtracks until now. Until, you know.
No, I would actually do it. They did the Final Fantasy Adventure and a cart music. That's like one of Kenji Ito's best tracks, and I would do that. But Pokemon,
Chow's like, I want to do it for Pokemon, but I would do it for that.
That is the most Chow response ever.
But I don't know. I'm with Josh here, man. This sounds like a total waste of plastic. Could you just like stuff all like songs in just like one cart? Like, why waste so much plastic?
Look, you're missing out on
you
the
don't
novelty,
understand
man.
How it works, yeah. Man. You don't. You just don't get it. Like, you just don't get it.
It's like cassette tapes.
It's,
you know,
it's because the way they want it is that like on the other side, the cartridge is like a print that looks like you want the music to match what's being shown on the fake Game Boy screen. Just game.
I guess that is worth mentioning too. Like, the design of the cartridges is like it has a screenshot of the of something in the Game Boy game. So like, if it's like your Showdown with Rival, for example. So if that musical cartridge has that track, that's the picture on the cartridge as well. Like the Showdown with Rival battle screenshot, which is something, I guess.
Oh, so that absolves them. So in order to do that, you just have to have 45 cartridges.
Yes. Yep, that's the only way. That's the only, you know, modern problems that require modern solutions, obviously.
Yeah, cool to hear that we're all relatively positive. Obviously, it was a very short, like, 3 minutes of footage to speculate on for the next several months. But we're all relatively positive on what was shown initially of Winds and Waves, even if we're not as positive on the Pokemon music cartridge doodads.
I think you're just dumb. That's it.
Let's see here. A few other headlines here not related to Pokemon. I think that wraps up everything related to Pokemon. So here we'll go through some other headlines. We'll go through some trailers and then, you know, wrap up from there. So this one I had to like double check with Josh and Anna before we started recording to make sure I had my my timeline put together. So we have an announcement of an English release of a new Disgaea game. Disgaea Mayhem is going to be releasing on Switch 2, PS5, Switch, and PC this summer. Now, this game has already released for Japanese audiences earlier in the year. It was originally announced as Kyuren Makaism, which is it's from New Planichi, from Disgaea developers, Disgaea talent, and even included like some Disgaea like cameos or crossovers.
I'm sorry, Brian. And, I have to stop you there. It's the pronunciation is Kyuren Makaism. It's not. It's okay.
If you had asked me, Brian, do you think you're pronouncing that right? Probably not. Kuron, you know, that, whatever. That's what it was. And then it got a kind of like quasi-localized English name when Clouded Leopard released the game in English for Asian markets, Makaism Frenzy of the Netherworld. So got a new name, and we had like precedent to believe that that would be the name when it eventually made its way overseas, but nope, we're getting it over here in Western markets this summer, and now it's officially adopting the Disgaea name. So now it is releasing here in the West as Disgaea Mayhem. So not originally a Disgaea title in name, even though it was, you know, by the same talent and already had some like Disgaea crossover content in some fashion, but here in the West, it will be a Disgaea game, a spinoff of sorts, I suppose. But yeah, releasing this year, we got a new trailer from NIS America showcasing, you know, the English gameplay for that game.
Yeah, so yeah, people like, you know, compare it to like, hey, it's Disgaea Dynasty Warriors. That's the kind of the gameplay loop, you know, presentation that they're showing. It is kind of, I can already imagine like the meeting to like change its name entirely to have Disgaea in the name, because just by popping in the word Disgaea in the title, that's like what plus at least 1,000 more units sold. The name Disgaea still has weight in the West, so it's kind of like a weird decision at first, but it's like, yeah, it does make sense if you want to just get more easy sales just by having that name on it. That's a cynical perspective.
No, I mean, I saw plenty of people saying, you know, showing interest in Disgaea Mayhem, having no idea that this game is already released and you can buy it and play it if you want in Japan. You know, like they had no idea. Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. So this one is kind of more on the business dev side. This is from not from RPG site, but this is from Gamatsu. We'll put a link to them in the description of the podcast post. But Koei Tecmo is transferring a part of Team Ninja over to Gust. Josh, I don't know like all the particulars here, but these are all under Koei Tecmo already, but they're just kind of like redistributing their talent amongst their existing
studios. Pretty much a reshuffle. It's not like they're some crazy reorg structure, but basically it's like, you know, Team Ninja is a fairly, you know, substantial development team under Koei Tecmo now, so it's not like it's not the division of Team Ninja that's been working on Neo or Ninja Gaiden. It's primarily the staff that's been working on like the Dead or Alive Venusification games and the Atelier Resli Oriana mobile game. Like that portion of Team Ninja is now gonna be, you know, working more closely with Gust and going like being integrated into them formally. So, and then now there's like this weird, like, you know, restructure in terms of like names. So this this transfer of Team Ninja's Division 1 going to Gust will now be renamed Gust Division 2. And now the current Team Ninja, as we know it, that didn't get integrated to Gust, will now be split into two divisions, Team Ninja Division 1 and Team Ninja Division 2. So as for like how that'll exactly impact their day-to-day operations, I'm not exactly sure. I'm also not exactly sure like where that leaves the ongoing service games of Dead or Alive, Extreme Venus Vacation, and Atelier Resliviana, because both of them are still in service in Japan. And I know for the Dead or Alive Venus Vacation in particular, it has like a Southeast Asian release that is also in operation as well. So I don't know exactly how those will be affected moving forward due to this restructure, if any at all. But that's kind of just like more business dev side of like, hey, they're, you know, Koei Tecmo is making moves and kind of making their... It's like an ongoing process because, you know, like Adam and I have been talking about this, especially on Koei Tecmo's side, where they just recently, you know, established this AAA game studio, and under that studio released the latest Hyrule Warriors entry on Switch 2. So there's like a lot of things going on under the hood for Koei Tecmo as they continue to try to adapt to the times moving forward, you know, getting prepared for the future and beyond.
And if I'm reading this right, this is basically turning three teams into four teams. Do I have that right?
I think so. Am I getting the math right, Adam?
Yeah, I think
this?
So, because one of the team into Division 1 is turning into Gust Division 2, so that's just a rename. I mean, I'm sure it's slightly more than a rename, but it's broadly just a rename. But then, like, the remaining Team Ninja Division is splitting. So, yeah, there is actually, ultimately, it'll be one more team. Because now we have two Team Ninjas, and we have two Team Gusts, or whatever. So,
because it's interesting, because depending on the context, sometimes you read news like this, and it's foreboding, because it's like, you know, Raven Software is now stuck in the Call of Duty mines or whatever. But this one seems like they're, you know, Team Ninja has been successful over the last several years across many of their different, you know, publishing partnerships. Or sorry, did I say Team Ninja? Koei Tecmo. So the fact that they're kind of like spinning out and splitting off their development teams into multiple more teams to support, you know, Dead or Alive, Atelier, Neo, Ninja Gaiden, all that. It's, to me, I read this and it seems positive.
I mean, I remember when Gust was not even a part of Koei Tecmo. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because I've said it before, but it's funny how like kind of silently Koei Tecmo has been like a real like powerhouse when it comes to like releasing games, because they just released like Neo 3, obviously massive game. They're releasing a new game in less than a week. Pacopia.
Yep.
They developed Pacopia.
Yep. They also have Fatal Frame 2's remake, and they have like Ninja Gaiden 4 DLC also coming out within weeks. They are like insane right now.
Yeah, and I do wonder.
Like, Imprisonment was not that long
ago. When was Ninja Gaiden 4?
Yeah. Yep.
How long ago was that?
Ninja Gaiden 4 was October.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. And the DLC is coming out next week, yeah.
And then, moving to the future, I wonder if one of these Team Ninja divisions will be primarily responsible for not only the development of, like, this new Dead or Alive entry, but also, like, the day-to-day operation of, like planning out, like, its future content plans, you know, when that game launches. Like what is, like, the... Not only what that game will be getting after launch, but also the roadmap of, like, the competitive scene of it. Like, are they going to be involved with, like, you know... making sure it has like a circuit like Tekken does, because Bandai Namco now has like an esports division that, you know, is responsible for like this, you know, Tekken World Tour. Will they have like a similar approach to that, and will that be part of that Team Ninja's responsibilities as well? So it's really, you know, interesting to see like how they're going to shake this out, because, you know, committing it's kind of like in a weird bind where like committing to a new fighting game in modern times means you need to have like a battle plan of sorts. If you really want to be involved in the esports scene, you need to have like a good roadmap and a good sense of like, okay, what is our distribution of events that we're going to be participating in? What is going to be like our competition structure on this? And do we have like a sort of like plan for that to support like the fighting game community in that regard? And that's not to get into like, you know, the complications that the FGC has been running into in very, very, very recently with the whole Evo shakeout, let's say.
It's not winning either way. I mean, even like Capcom, they have that stupid pay-per-view event, which is a complete shit show this year. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not a fan. It's looking dumb this year.
Yeah, it's the whole fighting game sphere at the moment has a lot of problems that they're contending with. Not even just like Capcom pay-per-view, but also the larger sphere. It's a really complicated time for them.
And then the last headline I have here is something that we are obligated to talk about because we teed it up last week when we had the new video from celebrating the Nier sales milestone, saying that at the very end, a little bit of a teaser, Nier Automata will continue, or whatever it said. Overwatch. So,
it's sure continuing.
All right, Josh, take it.
So I don't know if this was leaked or not by accident, but Wario64 got wind of it and reported, hey, the game formerly known as Overwatch 2, now known as Overwatch once again, is getting an upcoming collaboration with Nier Automata. And I joked when I was sharing, it's like, hey, remember that? Here's your Nier Automata to be continued. It's continuing in Overwatch. So, you know, I'm sure a portion of the heroes there will be getting Nier Automata skins for 2B, 9S, and A2, and whatever.
Funnily enough, despite what you might expect, Tracer's not getting the 2B outfit.
Wait, did they already announce which heroes are getting which? I didn't really look into
it.
I missed the trailer, but people, like, posted some... I think three of the new heroes, which, like, two of them I haven't even heard of. I haven't played Overwatch since the Persona 5 collab. That was the last time I booted it up. But I will definitely download it for this. Like, I have to see how this shit looks.
It feels like anything is, like, not off the table because they did that Gundam Wing collab not too long ago that tried to, you know, get them into...
They just finished up a Hello Kitty collab.
Oh, really? Okay. Nice. So, you know, but look, Nier Automata, no stranger to collabs. Especially, to 2B, you know, no stranger to collabs. She's been everywhere. You look at any piece of media, there's a 70% chance 2B has been in it, you know? So, it's not surprising. What did surprise the world by storm, though, the studio Kara had some announcements to make at the beginning of the week. They announced a brand new Evangelion series, and they announced that the series composition and script will be handled by Yoko Taro, and the composer for it will be Keiichi Okabe, who, you know, both are staples in the Nier series, obviously. So that definitely caught everyone by surprise. Like, wait, who's doing the script of the next Evangelion, and who's doing the music? And that's led to some very wild speculation throughout, you know, both the anime and gaming sphere, because these are two titans of media coming together.
I mean, it's not the first time Yoko Taro has worked on an anime, but
oh no!
Now you finally got your ending E in Evangelion, guys. You finally.
I mean, yeah, Taro has joked over the years, like, "Oh, don't praise Nier Automata too much. I just copied what Evangelion was doing. You know, give all the credit to Evangelion. You know, he's jokingly said that in interviews, but obviously Taro has a lot of reverence for Evangelion, and I'm very interested to see where this goes. And as you said, Chow, this is not the first time. Nier Automata got, you know, a TV anime adaptation, but he also was involved with the production of a original anime called Kami Erabe God App or something like that. And it was like a death game sort of anime. It didn't really catch my eye, but
there was another one called VV or something. It was like VIVY. Oh, it's like VV. I think it was called. I didn't watch.
I'm
it,
not too familiar with it.
Let me just give you a link in just a second.
Okay, but yeah, I mean, it's cool. Like, I'm still kind of wary of it because the This new Evangelion series has the co-directors Kazuya Tsurumaki and Toko Yatabe both helming it as, you know, co-directors on it, and they both worked on the Evangelion movies before, but Tsurumaki in particular was the head director of the recent Gundam G Klux series, and that was a series that was very, very cool at first, but I definitely didn't like where it went. And hearing more stories about how the production of that series went, I don't really agree with how this was made.
Did I read right that they just literally were just kind of winging it? Like they had real no story plan. That they're just like, we just kind of came up with things as we went along.
Yeah, that was TLDR of it. Yeah, it was like, it didn't really have like a firm vision from the get go.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. Never mind. He wasn't involved in that. I thought he did. Okay, never mind. I'm having a Mandela effect here, guys. Sorry.
So, either way, I really hope this new Evangelion series that these individuals are all involved with I hope it's like a brand new departure with new characters and like a new just everything. Don't be beholden by what Evangelion was before. But we'll see.
Don't be like G cracks.
Don't be like G cucks. Yeah,
hanging on too much of that nostalgia, trying to. I don't know. I have a very hard time trying to sell that to
people. It had its ending. It has definitive its ending. Move on, please. But at the very least, we'll probably get like a really phenomenal soundtrack out of this. If anything else, like Okabe, one of the really, really, really talented composer, and that's selling it short, obviously. But I attended a near concert once, and man, what a stellar individual.
I think that covers us for main headlines. Going into some other just like trailers that we got this week, Where Winds Meet is getting a series of like expansion chapters. They're calling it the first major expansion, Hexi, Hexi, which is going to be releasing in three chapters across March through May, called Jade Gate Pass, Long Xiao, and Qin Chuan. Chao, please put me across the head if I pronounce those wrong. Yeah, I tried my best.
You got the Chao Pass.
Yeah, hooray. But yeah, this is basically Where Winds Meet released back in November. And it's getting just like almost episodic. They're not using that phrase. They just call it an expansion releasing across three chapters starting in March. So and they obviously introduced the whole expansion with a quick little 90 second launch trailer this week. This one is a game that I forgot got announced last year. This is from Square Enix. This is for the Dissidia Duelum Final Fantasy. This is the Dissidia game featuring, you know, obviously, you know, Final Fantasy characters, but dressed in like contemporary urban gear. Like, I don't know how else to describe it. There's probably a better way to describe it. But they've announced an opening video trailer for this, an opening cinematic. And it is, without any context of what it's for, the fact that it's for a Dissidia game, it's actually kind of fun, I thought, where it starts out with like, I forget who it starts out with, but the earliest characters that it shows are like Prompto, like taking photograph of an urban environment. Lightning is like sitting outside on a, you know, on a porch of a coffee shop, and then like Cloud is strolling through the street, and then there's like that Final Fantasy 14 character, I don't know her name, with like the big like tall platform shoes, and
Gaia. It's like a Gaia or playing something. Or am I totally off the mark?
It's Gaia.
I forgot.
It's the
goth girl.
Okay, cool. Okay. And then I was gonna say it's the moon lesbian from the Sun and Moon Lesbian from those memes. but then like it shows Renoa playing in the park with I forget the
Angelo.
Like, who's, yeah. And I was like, if this was like if I had no context for this, like I'd play a game where you just play as like, you know,
but then reality sets in.
There were some fun comments on our post about it. Like, this almost looks like a dating sim. And people were like, if only it should be.
God, I wish. Oh, man. I mean, yeah, like the world setting is like fucking top notch for this. Unfortunately, that's not what it's advertising. But man, it was a dating sim. Holy shit.
And just to put it out there, Dissidia, this is a opening cinematic for a three versus three team boss battle arena game. Is what they're calling for it.
Yeah, with the gotcha mechanics.
Like an action if this, I'm trying to think, like, I don't want to sound too like whiny, but like, if this is just sort of like a, obviously, like, don't care about anything canon, just like play as different characters with different gear sets in like an urban environment fighting Final Fantasy enemies, like in an action game, like that'd be dope. But no, it's a 3x3 Dissidia game, which I'm not saying that's bad, but it's a known commodity. But
I'll take the dating sim. What was that game that SNK did? They had like a dating sim of all their fighting game characters or something.
I remember a manga of it. Like one of my friends was talking about. I don't know if there was a game over it, but that definitely there was like a SNK like isekai manga and like and them kind of getting hot over Kyo. That's all I remember from it. I forgot exactly the name of the manga and the exact premise, but I know it's like isekai manga and they were going feral over Kyo in it. That's all I remember.
I don't think I was reading through some of the other press release here. Like there's like raffles for giveaways to win some promotional merchandise. There's going to be a pre-registration login bonus. When my eyes start glazing over when I start reading this sort of stuff, like
they love items equivalent to
40 ability draws, including drog tickets and Mog Pay points.
I love gacha for abilities. In a PvP, I don't think this has direct PvP, but it's definitely a speed run like of like two competing teams of who defeats like enemy waves the fastest. I believe that's like the flow of the game, but it's still like you're still engaging with a gacha to hopefully get good abilities to make you kill things faster, and it's like it's still in a PvP setting. So that's what they've decided to work with and do. Like, okay, great. I don't know exactly if this will have legs, but you know.
Do you like Adam is the one that put this news post up on the site, and he's like, Scott had a chance to try out Dissidia last year during the closed beta. He says that if you're still waiting for classic Dissidia, you're still waiting. Like it's like a very polite way to say like he was mid on it. But yeah. But, you know, maybe we'll be surprised. And for what it is, in a vacuum, the trailer is a fun watch.
I'll take it for, like, new art assets and, like, and re-envisioning, like, you know, these classic FF characters in, like you said, like, urban fits, like, more contemporary, like, modern-day outfits. Like, how would they exist? Mm-hmm. And, at that opening cinematic, you had the fucking Warrior of Light aura farming.
There's some fun comments. There was one comment about, it's nice seeing Terra just be a normal teenage girl, because what Terra has to go through in Final Fantasy VI, you know, she didn't get the chance to be a normal girl.
Yeah, that was a really cool touch. Like, she's hanging out with, like, friends at a claw machine at an arcade, you know, just having the time of her life. It's like, fuck yeah. That's really cool.
When it showed Warrior of Light at the very end, I couldn't quite parse right away who it was. I'm like, is that Ravis from Final Fantasy XV? Eventually, I placed it. But I was just like, what the? Oh, that's Warrior of Light.
And it's also funny to like this has a lot of fun interaction potential in terms of like of the Warrior of Light being a fucking boomer, be like, what is modern technology? And the much younger like Zidane has to explain to Warrior of Light like what a fucking cell phone is and what can you do on it. Like, that's fun. Sure. That's awesome.
A couple other trailers here. A game that's releasing in early access this summer is a game I'm looking forward to, Outward 2, from Canadian studio Nine Dots. They did a quick gameplay overview trailer for this ahead of the early access release. So I kind of put this on the headline just because this is a game I'm looking forward to. I really like Outward 1. I want to revisit it.
I appreciate it wasn't just this game, but I kind of appreciated these sorts of like narrated trailers from a small team. Just narrated from the creative director who doesn't really have like actor voice or whatever. It's just like, hi, this is the game I want to make. And, you know, I want to talk to you about my game kind of thing. Kind of very candid. And, you know, feels
like they don't have like market training or anything. Or it's like, you know, you don't have like, here's how you should present your game or whatever. It's very like, hey, man, we're a small team and I want to just tell you with direct gameplay footage, you know, what we're making and how it works. You're totally right.
And Outward has done this from the first game, but kind of the angle they always go for is like, you are a normal person and you've run into a monster. What are you going to do? You don't have superpowers. Like, you have to stack the deck in your favor somehow to defeat this guy. And they're like survival action RPGs, right?
Yeah. I do want to play with a friend too. Like, this is something we'll probably get around to, but it's like maybe more in a full 1.0 state. But
that's where I'm at. Yeah.
Yeah.
And another game I'm looking forward to, Warhammer 40K Dark Heresy. This is the Alkite game. I think it's expected to go into...
Alpha recently.
I was going to say early access, but that's not the term they use.
I don't think they have alpha. The alpha already took place and ended.
Right.
But I don't know if they have like a release window. I reported that they didn't, because I didn't see one. I don't know if it's hiding on a Steam post somewhere, but I don't think they've ever narrowed down, like, when is it coming out?
Well, yeah, the news here is it's relatively small, but Rogue Trader is currently on its DLC like binge, and I'm at the point where I'm always at, where I'm like, I'm gonna wait for them all to come out and then I'm gonna get back in. So there's a little quick 30-second teaser for the new Rogue Trader DLC. So that's whatever. But then they also had a gameplay trailer for the Warhammer 40K Dark Heresy. This is not a DLC, this is the next game in the series. But Adelbrada pointed out that this is a gameplay trailer, but it's basically just like 80 seconds of someone in a combat encounter. Like, it's not...
I saw people in the... If you check the comments on this YouTube video, it's like people making fun of whoever's playing. Like, is this an IGN journalist? Like, they don't know what they're doing. Like, they're using the wrong skills.
Brian, you could speak to this, but when you see this Dark Heresy gameplay, is it pretty much like using the same foundation as what they did previously? And I forgot, it was already Rogue Trader.
Yeah. It's like the UI elements are different, the art's different, but you can tell it's got the same skeleton.
One thing that they explicitly mention is that in Dark Heresy you can like target individual like body parts, and that can do different effects. Okay. And that's a new wrinkle, as I understand it.
One of these days, I'll get back to Wrath of the Righteous with all of its DLCs.
Just whenever you have a spare 200 hours.
Yeah, and when I have a spare 150 hours. Yeah.
It's okay, but there's no new game releases coming out like in the next year or so. You'll have
time. There's no Pokemon game this year, so we'll be okay.
It's true.
Let's buy Brian a random RPG for his birthday. See how much backlog to sink.
This is a headline I didn't see until actually right before we started recording this. This is about the game World of Horror. World of Horror is a... Josh can explain it better than I can, but it's an indie game that we kind of gave its flowers back in 2023 as like this roguelike narrative game where it has like story elements that end up becoming like semi-randomized and pieced together in like a very monochrome, almost like 1980s Macintosh style visual aesthetic. If you type in World of Horror like art in a Google search, you'll see what I'm getting at. And we actually kind of gave it like, that's one of the game is a great game, but also like that's its probably most striking singular feature is just how it visually looks. Basically Josh spoke very warmly on it, and then I played it. I was like, hell yeah, this game's rad. It's going to get a free update. That's kind of the lead I'm bearing here, is that I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this right. The developer Panstez and publisher Yearsbird Games. I cannot pronounce words to get whatever they're from. I cannot pronounce them.
I don't know. I have no idea how you pronounce Yearsbird. Yearsbird?
Yearsbird is what I'm thinking too.
Yeah, Eastbird. But anyways, they've announced 1.2. And the reason why they're calling it 1.2 is because they say, we're planning to add stuff to this game that will roughly increase the game size by 20%. Hence 1.2. So they are they're adding basically new characters to play as, new allies. These are people that you can like either interface with in the quest or like recruit to be as part of like your battle party. Two new old gods, which are kind of like
antagonists. Describe them. Yeah, it's not the antagonists you're working towards to defeating in a run.
New items, new events, because it is like you end up like running into events at different locations. There's like a whole new location. Like basically the amount of, it's a roguelike-ish structure. So they're just basically adding to that. They're saying like, hey, now you can run into new events. There's a new location you can go to. You can run into new allies. And there's new enemies. So it's just like, this is not a long game. Like, well, it's because of its nature, you can kind of replay it and see a lot of different permutations about how the story can turn out, how you're, you know, once you get better at understanding how the game is organized and structured, you can make better decisions and be more efficient, you know, all those sorts of things, and see all the different permutations. So basically they're just saying like, hey, we're working on this. We don't have a release date yet, but they just wanted to say like, hey, you know, we want to get some eyeballs on this. We're currently testing it and we're excited to share more, and it's free to existing owners. So it's just a real cool update from a studio that's very, very passionate about the game that they made.
Yeah, I definitely want to check this out and like get back into it, because, you know, I kind of, I wouldn't say exhausted World of Horror, but there's definitely like you play it so much that you start seeing repeats of stuff. So them adding a shitload of new things, like, okay, why not? You know, that's really cool to just have out of nowhere and being releasing relatively soon. I don't know if they might have a date, but, you know, it'll be sometime out within the next few months.
Mm-hmm. They say in due course. But it's already in early QA testing, so hopefully, you know, not imminent, but soon.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of the headlines here are some release dates. So Madoka Monogatari, Fia and the Wondrous Academy, this game released last summer, is going to get its PC Steam release on March 25th. Tomb Water, this is like a Western indie Castlevania souls like I sorry that I just vomited all those words in order, is releasing on March 31st. I guess it's not really more like Castlevania, it's more top down, so it's not side scrolling, it's top down.
I always kind of feel a little bit we called it a souls like in our title, but that's using their words, they're calling it a souls like, you know,
right?
So yeah, they said it, not me.
I mean, sometimes we have to just try to describe something, but like in their press release, they say 2D Western Souls-like. Yeah. It's like, all right, that's what it is. That's the genre, 2D Western Souls-like. But no, it actually kind of gives me like GBA Pokemon vibes a little bit with a top-down perspective, but it looks neat. Utawara Ramono Lost Frag is shutting down on April 23rd. This is not actually a game I was aware of. Yeah, a mobile entry in the Utawara Mono series.
I thought the name was Lost Flag, not Frag, but I guess that makes sense. I thought it was.
Saw people wondering. I'm wrong. About okay. That, but yeah. If it was yeah. Frag or Flag. But yeah, I've seen people, you know, kind of upset about this because, you know, it's like all that art is going to disappear, you know, both visual art and writing, you know, it's like what they should do something. Like it just is a bummer. But I think it was like this did release 6 years ago. Which I, you know, it seems from what I hear, that seems pretty good for most
pretty long run.
Yeah,
most maybe not the top
notch mobile games, but yeah, but still, like
that's always the big loss for any of these games. Like whether you agree or disagree with like their monetization model and what their it is, it's still these sorts of games are still like gigantic art asset applications. You know, so it's always the biggest loss of like their. Rarely any of them get like art books, and very rarely do they get like offline versions or any way to access them after they're down.
The people made also the low hanging fruit joke, if you will. Like it's now going to be called Utawara Ramono Lost Media.
This last one actually probably could have been earlier in the podcast, but I just listed it last because it is a release date announcement and it is the furthest out chronologically out of the other ones. But Neverness to Everness, NTE, finally has a release date. It was going to be launching on April 29th worldwide for PC, PS5, and mobile devices.
Yeah, this also like launching April 23rd in China. So that version will be coming out first, and then the global version a week later everywhere else. Chow, are you going to give this a shot? I might give it a shot.
This I found this amusing, and maybe I'm just an idiot. But I was actually kind of commenting on how like April's release dates or like the release schedule in April is a little bit thin, you know, because there's games coming out, but it's just, you know, kind of a slowdown. And then the way that Chow phrased it was maybe April is gotcha time because he's excited for this game.
Yeah. Okay. Understandably so, but like, people get this and Ananta get mixed up a lot. This is the one that's like the supernatural urban. Usually, whenever they showcase it, usually during nighttime, and there's like car focused. Like there's a big car element in this game, and you can buy properties. While Ananta is the one that's like people know it as like the GTA, like with like Spider-Man web slinging and having like weirdly maybe too kind of borderline plagiarism sometimes with some of the stuff like the, like when people see part of like the combat, like your main character in Anata has like a sort of like web sort of powers, and some of the animations are very close to something you see in Spider-Man 2 at times. While Neverness to Everness is the one that is like made by the Tower of Fantasy devs and is, you know, like I said, very like one of the characters has like a gravity bending mechanic where you can like run up buildings and stuff like that. I don't know. I'll give it a shot.
Be committed. I mean,
I'm definitely not committed. You and me have been like, I don't know, here we go again. And after getting burned by like doing Night Abyss and like not improving in a timely
manner. I haven't logged in like.
I quit it ever since that. Whenever I said a few weeks back, like I stopped logging in, I just never went back. And amusingly enough, you do it Night Abyss. Well, we say it amusingly enough, but we don't really like mean that it's like it's a great situation. But like it got a hack. It got hacked sometime this week. It was a relatively harmless hack, thank God. Like people's payment information didn't get like.
It's the same hacker that hacked Infinite Nikki to tell you to go play Genshin instead.
Yeah, they fucked with the server list, and it's a very surface level hack. But they recovered, but it still sucks either way. And that game, New at Night Abyss, just not in a great spot in my opinion.
I'm sure the Genshin community hate this guy because this makes them look terrible. Like, every time I hack their game, I'll tell you, man, this game is kind of mid. I think you should play Genshin. Like, this is like every time from this hacker. I'm like, seriously, man? It's like, we just leave us alone. Just let us play this.
But yeah, we'll see how Neverness to Everness goes. I always fucking forget the name of this game. I just want to say NTE.
One letter short from NTE.
Yeah, don't. Look, man, of course, if we're going to compare it to NTR, it's. We're not going to get into that. But yeah, and this is like also kind of we'll see how the technical state of this goes, because this is like fancy schmancy built on Unreal Engine 5.7 with all the features of global illumination, multi-frame gen with DLSS4, etc., etc. I'm just hoping for a smooth experience at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping too. But when you hear Unreal Engine, it's just like, oh, that's not going to be
I know.
A good launch probably.
Open world game on the Unreal Engine 5. Here we go. We'll see.
I had to say, Arknight Enfields, that is like the smoothest gacha game I played ever. And that was on Unity Engine. I can't believe Unity Engine can do that.
Well, Anata's Unity, I believe.
Is it? Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Isn't Genshin also Unity?
Yeah, but, you know, they have their own fork. They have their own fork of it, right? So, you know, it's just like very good of.
Yeah, Genshin had a lot of learning pains because of, like, it was all, like, a trailblazer in some aspects, too, of the launching at that scope. And then, like, Genshin on day one on mobile devices wasn't a great site, you know? So, they obviously smoothed it out at the time. But yeah, I guess you and me will check out this Neverness to Everness thing when it launches and see if it's got any chops. You excited, chat? Here we go again!
This is my dose of Grand Theft Auto 6 before Grand Theft Auto 6 comes out. It's our appetizer.
That's why Pokemon's not releasing this year. It's
that's right. Maybe what you know what? That's not that's definitely a factor, right? You know, it's a fortunate byproduct. Whether we like it or not, the Grand Theft Auto 6 release date is a big factor in making.
Yeah, but I don't
a lot
think,
of business decisions.
I don't think it was a factor for the Pokemon delay, because if there's literally any media franchise that could hold its own against GTA would be Pokemon.
It's true. Yeah. They'll never, but you know, we'll never know the real story.
We'll never know. We'll never know.
They'll never admit it.
That covers all the headlines I had this week. I'm looking at the schedule for next week. It looks like a lot of the March releases are kind of mid-month. Like we have Greedfall, we have Monster Hunter Stories 3 are like mid-March. Crimson Desert is March 19th. So I'm not sure what lines up for like the first week of March, but we'll see what ends up on our plate next week. But yeah, give us a the articles that we shouted out, the Tower Bone review from Hayes, plus the interview, the very long interview from Mikhail with Dave Oshry from New Blood is up on the site. A couple different features, Alex on Star Trek Voyager, Cullen on Resident Evil Requiem, the usual performance reviews from Mikhail for Tales of Berseria and Fallout 4 on Switch 2. All those are up on the site, rpgsite.net. Join our Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite. If you search for RPG Space Site on any of the social media networks, you should be able to find us. If you like this podcast, leave us a like, leave us a rating. We love to see those. And until you hear from us next week, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.
Bomb on.